From KALW's The Spiritual Edge podcast, this is our series, Sacred Steps. We take you around the world to meet some remarkable people as they lean on their values and faith to challenge the status quo. I'm Judy Silber. And if after you're listening, you want to hear more of these stories, follow our podcast, The Spiritual Edge. In 2020, stuck in our homes, unable to participate in life as we'd known it before, the pandemic made it feel like the world stopped. It also gave us a chance to reflect. For example, on poverty, we all came to realize that essential workers were truly essential. During the pandemic, they were the most exposed, and yet they are the people in our society who often earn the least. We also had to consider, was it fair to evict people who couldn't work? This week on Sacred Steps, we profile a woman who was part of a new generation of anti-poverty activists in the United States. They're trying to rekindle the political and spiritual momentum of earlier social change movements from decades ago. In today's story, we meet Shali Gupta Barnes. She's a key strategist for the Poor People's Campaign. She wants to change the national conversation around poverty and basic human needs. Reporter Jess Ingebretson has her story.
It's a Friday night at the First Baptist Church in Selma, Alabama. As the wooden pews fill up, latecomers tuck coats and handbags onto the floor beside them. Up front, an organizer adjusts microphones.
So we'll start with Shali Gupta Barnes.
The crowd is here for a 2018 panel discussion sponsored by the Poor People's Campaign, a national anti-poverty organization.
Good evening. Can you hear me? All right.
43-year-old Shali rises to the pulpit, dressed simply in a long black tunic and loose white pants. Her silver earrings clink as she gestures. She reminds listeners of the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which began when the city's unelected emergency manager switched its water source without adequate testing or treatment. The corrosive water leached lead from aging pipes and delivered it to every tap and faucet.
And what happened was the city's population of 98,000 people, at the highest poverty rate of any American city, was poisoned. As Claire McClinton from the Flint Democracy Defense League says, though, they could not have taken our water without taking our democracy first.
Shali is the campaign's resident policy wonk. Her work, distilling data on present-day poverty, begins at gatherings in church basements, temples, and classrooms. She listens more than she talks. Then she combs through transcripts from these meetings, looking for common threads.
The issue of water was coming up in Alabama, where people didn't have sanitation. It was coming up in Michigan, where people's water was being shut off. It was coming up in Standing Rock, where indigenous communities were fighting to protect their water against pipelines. It was coming up in California. What is happening around water in this country?
Once she's identified a key issue, she digs deeper, reading economic reports and consulting with experts. These elements, personal testimony and academic research, shape the policy agenda of the Poor People's Campaign. Its larger goal is to change how we in the land of the American dream think and talk about poverty. Whether we mean to or not, most of us internalize the idea that being poor means you screwed up.
There's a very strong narrative of people who aren't working hard enough, people who have the wrong values, people who don't know how to save, they're not educated, they're lazy, they're crazy, like all these kinds of things.
These narratives, Shali says, don't just divide poor people from wealthy people. They divide poor people from one another.
You're still going to say, but I work hard, so I just got to work harder. I'm not actually poor. You know, I have student debt, credit card debt. I'm not sure if I'm going to make my rent this month. But I'm not poor because I know what I should be doing. I'm just not doing it well enough.
Turns out that a lot of Americans are poor. Over 140 million are either poor or low income, according to the Federal Supplemental Poverty Measure. That's almost 44% of the U.S. population.
We talk about sometimes,
breaking the isolation of people who think that this is just them, it's just their fault, it's just my problem, and moving from that position of self-blame to actually making a social claim on our government and on society to make what we need possible.
To grow that movement, today's Poor People's Campaign builds on a history that many Americans have forgotten or never learned. In 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. and other activists launched an earlier Poor People's Campaign, an organizing effort that connected civil rights to economic justice. They urged the federal government to guarantee the right to a meaningful job at a living wage. To build support, Dr. King barnstormed the South, promoting what he called an economic bill of rights.
Now, I want some of you all to go to Washington with us, even if you have to bring your whole family.
Thousands answered that call. They arrived by bus, by car, by mule.
We are going to have in Washington facilities, and we're going to have food, and we are going to demand that the government...
To demonstrate their commitment to stay until the government met that demand, campaigners built 3,000 wooden huts on the National Mall. They named the encampment Resurrection City. By night, the inhabitants connected with their new neighbors. Mexican-American organizers mixed it up with tenant farmers from Mississippi and teenagers from Appalachia. By day, they lobbied policymakers throughout D.C., as this participant from Louisiana explained.
We will go to Senator Long. He may not want to hear us. As he keep hollering law and order, but where in the hell is justice?
Events beyond its control clouded the vision of the Poor People's Campaign. An assassin killed King in April 1968, and another took down presidential candidate Bobby Kennedy 2 months later. The escalating war in Vietnam drained political will and money from the federal war on poverty. By summer, police in riot gear demolished Resurrection City.
I did not know anything about the Poor People's Campaign.
Shally didn't encounter the history of the Poor People's Campaign until she was in her 30s. She grew up with the textbook I Have a Dream, MLK, the reformer, not the revolutionary.
For most of my childhood and early adult years, my life was pretty apolitical. I just kind of moved through these hoops.
In a tight-knit Indian immigrant community in the Chicago suburbs, she spent much of her childhood playing in friends' backyards and tearing around the neighborhood with her sister. A constant was the local Hindu temple her parents helped establish. Shally spent time there soaking up the aromas of lemon and tamarind rice. In religious education classes, she studied Hindu texts like the Bhagavad Gita. Her parents and religious teachers emphasized two ideas, dedication and detachment. Dedication is digging in.
The injustice exists in the world. We have a responsibility to engage with it and to try to do something about it.
While detachment is letting go.
And there are limits to what we can do.
These were not abstract ideas in the Gupta household. Shally remembers stressing about a biology exam in high school. Her dad counseled detachment.
He actually offered a lesson from the Gita. And what he said was, you've been working hard in studying for this exam. You've done that work. And now you just have to take it. And what he said was kind of be detached from the results. Like whatever happens, you've done your share. And now things are a little bit out of your hands.
All this made sense to Shally. Do what you can do and let go of the rest. She kept leaping through those hoops. An economics degree from the University of Chicago, law school at UCLA, then a job at a top-shelf firm in Southern California. A couple years in, she worked with one of the partners on a big entertainment law case. They won a major victory.
And he turned to me, I was a young lawyer, I was 25 years old, he goes, I love it when the wheels of justice turn the wrong way. And he was talking about a victory we had, and all of a sudden I kind of had to stop and think about what was I doing?
Her partner, Adam Barnes, was asking similar questions. After months and many conversations, they decided to try a different path.
And so she, walked into her boss's office and told her that she was quitting her job and joining the Peace Corps.
Shally and Adam were posted to Niger, the largest country in West Africa. They arrived in the capital in 2004, in their mid-20s and newly married. After a month of training, a colleague dropped them off in their new home, the rural farming village of Kochitamu. Their job was to rehabilitate the village's exhausted soil, digging holes to catch rainwater that would nourish crops. To their new neighbors, it seemed like a fool's errand. Adam thought often of what a Peace Corps colleague had told him.
It's like coming into a place, standing on a corner with a sandwich board, naked, saying, "I'm here to help."
In their first year, Shally and Adam muddled through conversation in Zarma, the local language. By year two, they had gotten to know the local Sufi Muslim leader, the region's sheikh. After a good harvest, farmers brought their excess crops to his granary. In a lean season, hungry families asked him for food. Every time, he said yes.
Grains do not last past a certain time, so they were not meant to be hoarded. They were meant to be redistributed to anyone who needed them, whenever they were required.
That system made an impression on Shally and Adam. It seemed to require the community's leaders to redirect wealth toward those who most needed it.
They described it as their barka, or their blessing. It's almost what I would say in Hinduism, I'd always compare it to the idea of dharma or duty. Because they were in that leadership position, their duty was to improve the conditions of the people. And I remember asking, well, what if you don't? And the response from the religious leadership was, then the community will remove us. The community will see that we are not the leaders that they need.
As their Peace Corps contracts wound down, the sheikh's granaries stayed with them. In Kochitamu, leaders felt called by their faith to meet basic human needs. Was there a way to bring that commitment back home to the U.S.? For Adam, studying religion was the next step. In 2006, when the couple returned to the U.S., he enrolled at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. As Adam learned more about the progressive Protestant tradition, Shally revisited her own Hinduism.
That's when I kind of returned to some of the things I had grown up with and started to wonder, how does detachment work when you're in constant struggle? How do you make sense of that?
After Niger, detachment seemed fatalistic, like a call to accept injustice and suffering. Yet returning to the text she'd studied as a kid yielded a revelation.
The biggest lesson that I came out with by revisiting those texts was that God takes a position against injustice. God is not neutral.
Then she noticed another detail in what her father had told her when she was in high school.
Recognizing that you alone cannot change everything.
It's not that you can't build a better world. It's that you can't do it all by yourself.
And I think the notion of detachment asks us to keep that egotism in check and put ourselves in relationship with other forces and other people.
In other words, the flip side of detachment might be solidarity.
You're listening to KALW's The Spiritual Edge podcast. You can hear more great stories like the one you're hearing right now by following The Spiritual Edge in your podcast app, or go to thespiritualedge.org. And please, invite a friend to listen too. Now back to the story.
In 2009, anti-poverty organizers at Shally's husband's seminary launched a new leadership school. Over 100 leaders, mostly poor people, would gather to share ideas and strategize in the West Virginia woods. The organizers asked Shally if she'd come along too, It was just a year into the Great Recession.
A lot of people were still reeling from that crisis. The massive housing insecurity and, you know, the job loss and all of that was still kind of spiraling out. And I had no idea how bad things were.
Despite her brush with poverty in Niger, Shally felt insulated. She came from an upper middle class family. She was a lawyer with 2 graduate degrees. She realized she had plenty still to learn.
I had never been in a space like that before. Our discussion of economics, our discussion of history, our discussion of, you know, how poverty was legal, all of their insights just broke through my understanding of the world at that time. It made me revisit everything I thought I knew. And once that happened, I really couldn't turn back.
At first, she worried that her own background might position her as an outsider. With time, that fear faded.
It is kind of an ongoing conversation I have with myself sometimes. And I've, in the past few years, stopped having it, in part because I've reconciled to myself that this is my life commitment. And so, for whatever reason, karma, dharma, whatever it is, this is the position I found myself in, and all of my life's experiences have brought me to this point.
Before long, Shally started working full-time for the group that had organized the West Virginia Gathering. Today, it's called the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice. It's a core member of the Poor People's Campaign.
We wanted to conduct an audit.
This is Reverend Liz Theo Harris, co-chair of the present-day Poor People's Campaign.
We asked Shally to head up that process, looking over the past 50 years, where things had been when Dr. King and the welfare rights leaders and others had called for a Poor People's Campaign in 67 and 68, and where they were in 2017, 2018, 50 years later.
Shally pulled together a 120-page report called The Souls of Poor Folk.
And we saw that over those 50 years, all of the injustices that King was calling out, whether it was around voting rights, the racial wealth gap, job insecurity, housing security, all of these things have worsened.
To change this trajectory, the campaign developed a set of policy demands tailored to 2018. Leaders worked to build support through mass meetings, marches, and music. We have a new unsettled voice and we are powerful. Then the pandemic arrived, changing the shape and sound of solidarity. No more packed meeting rooms, no more singing in poorly ventilated church basements.
Welcome to the digital Poor People's Assembly and Moral March on Washington.
The campaign had planned a march on Washington for June 2020. Because of COVID, the march moved online. 2.5 million people watched via live stream. Participants testified on a webcam. They formed a montage of faces in squares. A Wisconsin woman in a multicolored sweater.
I'm Natalia Fajardo, and 4 weeks ago, I was okay. Until this pandemic hit, all of a sudden, the chocolate factory I work for closed, so I'm out of work.
An older couple in Florida leans toward the camera, photos of their son blurry on the wall behind them.
We have been on a complete roller coaster ever since Anthony has been incarcerated. Anthony is a paraplegic 40-year-old black man who was shot in the back at age 20.
A young man in a dress shirt and red tie.
I grew up around mountaintop removal sites, natural gas, hydraulic fracturing. The water that ran into our house that we bathed in, we couldn't drink. We couldn't drink the water we bathed in.
By the end of the virtual march, 300,000 participants had sent letters to their elected representatives, pressing for campaign priorities like rent relief and a $15 federal minimum wage. Co-chair Reverend Liz Theo Harris says the pandemic has pushed more Americans to recognize what its organizers have talked about for years.
If somebody doesn't have health care, it means that everybody's health is in jeopardy. If somebody doesn't have a place to stay and is homeless, then staying in place and social distancing isn't really possible.
Through the summer of 2020, Shally kept busy writing a stinging report on the Federal CARES Act. That pandemic relief measure, she wrote, provides wealthy Americans with a comprehensive welfare program, while offering the poor only piecemeal and haphazard relief. Her analysis draws on Martin Luther King Jr.'s thinking.
King said that the prescription for the cure rests on an accurate diagnosis of the disease. And there was never an accurate diagnosis of either the pandemic or the economic impacts of the pandemic. Who was most affected, in what ways, and then how to deal with that. And so months out from it now, we've seen billionaires increase their wealth by over $1 trillion.
At the same time, the pandemic has slammed low-income families. They're more likely than middle-class families to have lost jobs and to struggle to pay for food, rent, and medical bills. To change that, she wants bold action.
Debt relief, not just saying that you're not going to be evicted if you don't pay your rent, but actually just canceling that rent. Expansion of social welfare programs in terms of food security, housing security, income security, offering regular guaranteed payments to people on a regular way, not just a one-time stimulus, but recurring payments. We would need a massive expansion of good jobs, expanding public health, addressing the climate crisis. All of these things are possible.
Wishing won't make all this happen, she says. That's where the broader work of the Poor People's Campaign comes in. Getting people from different regions, ethnic backgrounds, education levels to talk and strategize, to realize they're fighting the same fight.
There are 140 million people who are poor or one emergency away from being poor. And of those 140 million, 66 million are white and 74 million are people of color. Unless these people actually come together, we're not going to be able to fight for these really big solutions. We're going to get these kind of piecemeal Band-Aids that will save some of us for a little bit, but they're not the solutions that are going to fundamentally change the direction of where we're heading.
That means pressuring elected officials, from the city council member to the president to the Democratic majority in the Senate. It's the next phase of a long fight. Shally recalls the Bhagavad Gita, the story her dad emphasized when he tried to explain detachment. In the midst of a battle, its central figure, Arjun, is a warrior who's not so sure he wants to keep fighting. Most of the Gita consists of Arjun's conversations with the god Krishna, who counsels him. In no uncertain terms, Krishna tells Arjun, keep fighting.
That's sometimes what I think gets lost in a reading of the Gita that doesn't actually put it in the context of a war. You know, Krishna is making all of these arguments, not so Arjun retreats to his home and pulls himself out of the world, but Krishna offers him this advice to get Arjun to pick up his bow again and to go back into battle.
Yes, in the end, whatever happens, happens. In the meantime, Shally says, she'll keep fighting. For The Spiritual Edge, I'm Jess Ingebretson.
That story is part of the Sacred Step series, produced by KALW's The Spiritual Edge in collaboration with USC's Center for Religion and Civic Culture. Visit our website, thespiritualedge.org, for more stories, transcripts, photos, and other links. And if you like what you're hearing, please rate or review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps us out a lot. Support for Sacred Steps comes from the John Templeton Foundation and the Templeton Religion Trust. Cheryl Duvall is the Sacred Steps editor. Tarek Fuda is the engineer. Tom Levy is the photographer for The Spiritual Edge. We're grateful to all the people who helped get this Spiritual Edge podcast out into the world, including Megan Suisse, Heva Farag, Sadia Termizi, Ben Trefney, Shireen Adel, Jeffrey Burke-Witten, and Megan Jones. You can subscribe to the Spiritual Edge podcast wherever you listen. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And please tell your friends. We'll be back soon. I'm Judy Silber. Thanks for listening.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.